time, and we were waiting for the press conference to begin, and those who were following the news 2 days ago do remember very well how long it took for the two ministers to eventually attend the press conference, and both of them definitely seem to be on the same page. Danny, since you mentioned 7 years of severed relations, I have to tell you that it is quite obvious that the two sides have let bygones be bygones, and they have definitely started a new chapter. They've turned a new page, and both of them are on the same page in this new chapter, basically on key issues with regards to the region and beyond, including security. The fact that President Ibrahim Raisi has always been a strong advocate of securing the region only with the help of regional countries and not allowing foreigners to meddle in regional issues. This is something that we heard exactly the words come out of the mouth of the Saudi foreign minister, which was very heartwarming to see that the Saudis actually do agree with the Islamic Republic of Iran when it comes to security issues. And of course, we do know that the security officials did also meet in Moscow with regards to that just a few weeks ago. And of course, after this meeting, we were not expecting another meeting to take place, but we were surprised by the fact that instead of returning to Tehran after that one-day trip, the trip has been extended, and then we had to fly to Jeddah instead of Tehran. And then speculations began about why we had to fly to Jeddah, and, of course, the reason it didn't take very long for us to realize why that was, and that was a meeting with the Saudi Prime Minister and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and this was, I believe, the icing on the cake, showing that the two sides are definitely expanding their relations. And in the words of the Iranian foreign minister, as we talked to him on the plane while we were flying back to Tehran, he said that the Saudis are adamant in making these relations expand to greater levels than what they used to be.
And it's funny, Gisu, we don't really have much time left, probably about 30 seconds, but it seems like you mentioned a new chapter, and the rhetoric we've seen, the talks about unity and strengthening forger ties, we didn't have this. Even before this 7 years ago, that diplomatic ties were severed, they were always on somewhat frigid, on ice, they weren't really that close, but the rhetoric we're seeing, we're possibly going to see a new chapter where we've seen better ties than we've ever seen between the two.
You're absolutely right, Daniel. All the signs are there, and for anyone who wants to read between the lines, I said this before, there are several issues that were mentioned. For example, the friendly soccer matches that will be resumed between the two countries, Iran offering full support for the 2030 Expo in Saudi Arabia, and also we do know that parliamentary commissions will resume their operations. So these back and forth meetings definitely mean something, and this is far beyond what it used to be between Iran and Saudi Arabia. We should expect a great change in the political equations of the region.
Thank you. This is Gisu Misha Ahmadi there, joining us out of our Tehran studio. Stay safe, Gisu, and thank you for that update.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And now we're going to introduce our two guests for our Spotlight program. Christopher Pelalia, researcher and political analyst, joining us from Verchères, Vermont. And Don DeBar, activist and commentator, joining us from Ossining, New York. Hello, gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in Vermont with you, Christopher Pelalia. Iran and Saudi Arabia warming up ties. Your thoughts on the geopolitical win this can be for both countries?
This is a major development, and I think it's a testament not only to the diplomatic skill of the negotiators on both the Iranian and the Saudis side, but also of the Chinese, who were able to bring these two parties together and to reach a consensus. So it shows not only a new geopolitical reality in the region, but much broader in Asia, of the rising influence and importance of China in terms of peace, peace negotiations, brokering deals, and so on. So this is a really big development. I think ultimately it's going to change a lot of the security architecture of the region. It's going to have a major impact on social, cultural, and religious aspects in the region, especially, increased probably in pilgrimage to the two holy sites in Saudi Arabia. It's going to be a great boon for the economy, for hopefully investment in Iran's oil industry, in its technological industries, in health and human services, in a wide variety. And I think ultimately it's going to de-escalate other tensions that have been stoked, not necessarily by these two countries, but by outside actors who have wanted to destabilize the region for quite a long time to achieve their own geopolitical interests.
Thank you, Christopher, for your opening statements there. And Mr. Don DeBar, welcome to the program, sir. How significant is this mending of ties from your perspective? Obviously, the relationship is about to re-evolve, perhaps more intimately than it has in the past, before the seven-year severing that we just mentioned with our correspondent there. So what are the ramifications now for Western influence in the region once we see a warming of ties between Riyadh and Tehran?
It has implications, first of all, regionally, obviously. It can, create a climate of peace, in essence, and sort of a bulwark against, foreign interference there. Because each time the United States has gone into the area, it's used either Turkey or Saudi Arabia, for example, as a proxy and or ally and or staging area. And so, this will negate a good part of that, especially when there's a common common plan in place. This itself has huge implications both for petroleum globally, for petroleum markets, for the producers, in essence, their position as against the consumers. And it also has, for that reason, for the regional reasons, and also just intrinsically, major implications globally in the context of a rising multipolar world. Unity in that region between the two great powers there can only help that rise as one of the poles. Sun Tzu wrote, a very long time ago, an evil enemy will burn his own nation to the ground to rule over the ashes. Instead of that kind of fighting, so I can be in charge of what's left of this region, this is, the smart thing, the necessary thing to do, and I'm amazed and I'm very pleased to see it happen.
Thank you, Mr. DeBar. And Christopher, we know the so-called Abraham Accords, they attempted to see ties normalized between Israel, Bahrain, Morocco, the United Arab Emirates, engineered, you very well remember, by the Trump administration. So how will those nations fare now as a result of this warming of ties between Riyadh and Tehran? And what do you feel will be the fate of the Abraham Accords? Now we're going to probably see U.S. influence in the region waning and Tel Aviv becoming more isolated.
I think we'll split some of those countries. I think the UAE is watching very closely. There are many Iranian expatriates who live in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. So the UAE is trying to strike a balance here with its own interests. Of course, don't forget, after signing the Abraham Accords, the UAE was promised high-tech military equipment from the United States. Israel immediately blocked it, so it hasn't received that. So it has already been on the losing side of the Abraham Accords, and it recognizes that warming relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran will only benefit it. Whereas, for example, Morocco, which is continuing its brutal occupation against Western Sahara, against the Sahrawi people who are fighting with the Polisario Front, they are very close to Israel. In fact, deepening their military ties, Israel helped them to build the wall in Western Sahara, one of the longest in the world. So I think that these two, for example, will be very different. I think Morocco is deepening its ties. It sees Israel, the United States, and its European allies as important for its continued domination over another Arab population, the Sahrawi people, whereas the UAE is on the losing side of the Abraham Accords and is probably going to see a warming of ties between the Saudis and the Iranians as being a beneficial thing. And ultimately, it is going to wait and see what's going to happen. Israel is getting more isolated globally and internationally. That much is true, given what it's doing against the Palestinians and the far right-wing government of Netanyahu, which is changing laws, changing the judiciary. And so even liberal Zionists are now against Israel. It's unprecedented, unheard of. We would have never thought this could happen 20 years ago. But I think ultimately it's going to fracture, no doubt about it.
And Mr. Dabar, I'd like you to weigh in on that too. The Abraham Accords, two out of the three, possibly three out of the three of Bahrain and UAE for sure, possibly Morocco, were all vassal states of the Saudis. So once Saudi Arabia and Iran start to take command of the region again, what will that mean for Tel Aviv and the so-called Abraham Accords?
Well, let's take the example, for example, of Bahrain. I mean, Bahrain is a vassal of Saudi Arabia. The Saudis came in when you had the uprising back in 2011 or whenever it was. But the Saudis are acting on behalf of the United States, which has a military base that takes up some huge proportion of that country. If the Saudis are to act in their own national interest as opposed to the interests of the United States, in other words, if they're to exercise sovereignty instead of acting as a vassal itself of the United States, the natural relationships that will evolve in that region will be based upon solidarity and supporting each other's sovereignty and facing the world together as a unit, because that is where the strength will lie. I'm thinking, again, I'm going to go across for a second, the oil markets, petroleum markets. If you consider Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Algeria, Nigeria, a few of these others, bringing to life some actual unitary sense that we are the producers, not just OPEC Plus, but where they're trading with each other as full equal partners, et cetera. The power on the world stage will grow immensely, and it'll benefit every one of them.
Thank you. And Christopher, as it seems the U.S. has ratcheted up tensions against Russia and China, there's been what a lot of people have been considering some serious change in the world, the so-called New World Order, where we're seeing immense change in Africa, in the region of West Asia. So what is changing today from your point of view, and who's going to be the winner and who are they going to be losers in this so-called New World Order?
I think ultimately U.S. hegemony is on the decline. It's on life support, but it's in no way gone yet. And that's the real the danger here. Whenever an empire collapses, the danger is that it will lash out like a cornered animal. The problem is in the nuclear age, that's even more dangerous, given the fact that lashing out means the annihilation of our species and of life as we know it on planet Earth. So I think it's very important to understand that the development of a new world order, of a multipolar order, of a peaceful system where sovereignty is respected, where peace reigns, where there's justice in international affairs, that can only come, hopefully, diplomatically. And the problem is that the conflict now in Ukraine, the meeting happening between United States, Japan, and South Korea, that's going to make even more moves in the Pacific. And there's even talk of NATO opening an office in the Pacific. It's Atlantic, now it's going to the Pacific. I think ultimately the United States is trying to maintain its hegemony however it can. It cannot win on 5-6 fronts. So it's focusing now in Ukraine. It's going to focus against China. But obviously it's going to have areas where it can't maintain command and control. It's happening now in West Asia. It's happening in Africa, especially with Niger, Burkina Faso, and other countries that are moving against the neocolonial regime, against the imperialist regime. But ultimately, what this could mean is war. Obviously, the global South, these BRICS countries, a lot of their followers are going to rise up. The non-aligned are going to win in this. But the question is whether they're going to win peacefully or whether there's going to have to be bloodshed to win that. My hope is that this can be a peaceful transition. However, it looks like the United States won't go quiet into that long night.
Thank you, Christopher. Mr. Dondebar, if you could, please, I'm going to put the same question to you. This reconstitution we're seeing in alliances in Africa, in West Asia, in East Asia, in Central and South America, your thoughts on how things are changing in the world, and who are the winners and losers?
The winners are going to be pretty much all of humanity, with the exception of the elite that currently runs the Western construct. There's been a parasitic relationship that using the state power of the United States and Europe, Japan, and South Korea, some others, but on behalf of the elite that actually makes policy for these and that reaps the bulk of the benefits. If you look at income distribution, wealth distribution, power distribution in any of those nations, you'll see really there's a very small group of people that benefit from it. Everyone will benefit from undoing that system, including the people in those countries. And particularly, of course, the people whose blood has been sucked for hundreds of years in some cases by the European colonialists and then the Americans who took their place. It's inevitable that this would happen. I agree that the danger is that of facing a wounded animal that's cornered. And historically, you know, that's borne out by collapsing empires. Nevertheless, humanity has an awful lot of skill and talent and resilience in its nature, basically. And I'm hoping we will fumble our way to a place where we can get these lunatics' hands off the death button and take control of our future for all of us.
Thank you, Don. And Christopher Helali, two conflicts that have plagued the region for quite some time, the war on Syria and the war on Yemen, and Iran and Saudi Arabia have been on opposing sides of both of these conflicts. So how can improved ties between the two bring stability to Syria and possible end to the war and blockade on Yemen?
Well, I think already we're seeing transformations on the ground. Just this past, you know, year or so, we've seen, you know, Syria readmitted to the Arab League. We've seen meetings with Bashar al-Assad as president with other Arab leaders. We've seen a resumption of diplomatic relations. We've seen an ending of major hostilities in Yemen. There's still some sporadic fighting, but overall, some level of peace is holding while diplomacy is working behind the scenes. I think overall what we're seeing is that, you know, these two quote-unquote proxy wars in the region, which are just on opposing sides, they're different groups. And of course, the United States and its allies and Israel have played a very negative role in stoking tensions in the region. I think that Iran and Saudi Arabia are going together to play a constructive role to rebuild Syria, to rebuild Yemen, and to begin to rebuild West Asia in a very positive, people-centered manner, and not in the extractivist rentier state that you know, the Western powers have long looked at the West Asia for, and seen only those countries as resources and not cared about the people, the history, the culture, the religions, etc. So I think ultimately we're on the right track here, and I am cautiously optimistic that peace will continue to prevail and diplomacy will prevail, and that human spirit that Dunbar was speaking about will prevail throughout West Asia.
And Mr. Dunbar, I saw you nodding your head. If you could, go ahead and weigh in on that as well.
I really can't say more than he just said very eloquently. This is exactly what, you know, a healthy evolution of our species would walk exactly in that direction. And it seems to be, it's a part of our spirit, I guess, that's irrepressible. As much as I'm thinking of Star Wars, when you say, the tighter you squeeze, the more will escape through your fingers. The more repressive the architecture of this Megillah that has charge of a large part of the planet that's losing its grip, the tighter they squeeze, you know, the more creative and the more assertive the rest of us become, of necessity. And I'm looking at just things like all of the countries that the United States has tried to isolate, take to Iran and Venezuela. When Iran and Venezuela start to work together, all of a sudden the entire dynamic changes. And that was some very creative diplomacy on the part of both countries. I was very pleased to see Iran initiate a lot of that. And that is the way of the future if we're going to have a future.
And Mr. Don DeBar, one more thing. We see this deal to have Iran and Saudi Arabia merge in one room and start talking again. It was brokered by China. It brought diplomats over to its neck of the woods and kicked this thing off back in March, making this play happen. So my question to you, obviously heads in the Pentagon and up on Capitol Hill are watching this very closely, these developments. What is the next play in the region for Washington when it sees that its influence is waning? Does it make it a more dangerous animal in West Asia?
I mean, their primary technique is divide and conquer. I mean, that's been true, you know, for maybe six centuries now, maybe going back to Rome even. In the Islamic world, I won't even have to go into that. The various, you know, religious sect differences were preyed upon, played upon, exploited, and weaponized. In Ukraine, as a matter of fact, the legacy of the history there between Roman Catholicism and Orthodoxy. We're seeing that played out in Ukraine, even by Zelensky right now, breaking off from the Russian Orthodox Church and all of that. They look for anything that will divide people and push it, exploit it using the media power that they have or have had, and also at gunpoint training people, arming both sides, doing things that will have people killing each other and destroying each other's ability to function, basically, while they walk in and walk away with everybody's stuff. That's basically what happens. Okay. I think you have to watch out for that. Unity is the word of the day, I think, and this is a major step forward in that direction.
And we only have about 30 seconds left. Christopher Hilali, your final thoughts on the kind of dangers now posed by Washington and its allies to try to regain some kind of influence in a losing battle in the Middle East and West Asia.
The dangers will be the United States giving a major military package to the Saudis, trying to push the Saudis into normalizing ties with Israel, further bolstering Israel, maybe even supporting Israel's aggression against Iran and other countries in the region. I think that there's great danger on the horizon, but there's also great prospects for peace. So we must continue to advocate and to be loud about the need for peace, negotiations, and a just resolution to all the conflicts in the region and a bringing together of these peoples in unity, really.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program, and stay safe to both of you. That was Christopher Hilali, their researcher and political analyst, joining us from Verkshire, Vermont, and Don DeBar, activist and commentator, joining us out of New York. And this brings us to the conclusion of this installment, everyone, of your Spotlight program. Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the verses of chapter Nur, the 24th chapter of the Holy Quran, and different commentary points of these verses. Brothers and sisters, let's listen to the 29th verse of chapter Nur.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم ليس عليكم جناح أن تدخلوا بيوتا غير مسكونة فيها متاع لكم والله يعلم ما تبدون وما تكتمون
There is no blame upon you for entering houses not inhabited, in which there is convenience for you. And Allah knows what you reveal and what you conceal.
Brothers and sisters, as we said, from the 27th verse forward, the points mentioned in the verses changed and somehow turned to mentioning some regulations of morals. How to control these regulations and how the people should have self-control over themselves when specifically they want to treat and have relations with other members of the society and community. The Muslim community must preserve itself from any kind of corruption. So that's why they have to observe some rules, some regulations, some morals in order to save their society. So, in the 27th verse, it was stated that there are some social orders that are really closely related to saving chastity, saving purity of the members of community, and it is how to enter people's home. This is a very important issue. And in the 28th verse, it was said that you do not need any permission if it was for your own house, and if you do not find anyone in it, it does not mean that the permission is granted. It does not necessarily mean the permission is given to you. فَلَا تَدْخُلُهَا حَتَّى يُؤْذَنَ لَكُمْ So you do not have to enter until permission is given to you. وَإِن قِيلَ لَكُمْ فَرْجِعُوا فَرْجِعُوا If you are told to turn back, if you are rejected, you have to return. There is no worries. You do not have to get upset about this because there are some reasons that you do not need to be curious about. Because the landlord knows better when he or she needs to receive some guests. Now, in the 29th verse, it is said, لَيْسَ عَلَيْكُمْ جُنَاحٌ أَن تَدْخُلُوا بُيُوتًا غَيْرَ مَسْكُونَةٍ فِيهَا مَتَاعٌ لَكُمْ It is no sin for you that you enter uninhabited houses wherein you have some goods. Public places that have no special inhabitants, such as hotels, such as shops and baths, which are open to all and people can enter and enjoy their advantages, are treated differently than personal homes. These places require no permission for entrance, and specifically, if you have some goods, if you have some items in there, you do not need to ask for permission. لَيْسَ عَلَيْكُمْ جُنَاحٌ It is no sin for you. So, in view of the fact that each ordinance has some exceptions through which problems and difficulties are solved rationally, in this verse, it is solved in this way, that you do not need to ask for permission if you are entering uninhabited houses.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Brothers and sisters, entering a place is so important in Islamic view that the Holy Quran says Allah knows what you reveal and what you conceal. This means entering public places needs some specific rules. You need to consider that the Almighty Allah. You need to consider the fact that the Almighty Allah is totally aware of all your thoughts, all your actions, and what you do and what you want to do. Because the verse says, يَعْلَمُ مَا تُبْدُونَ وَمَا تَكْتُمُونَ. He knows what you reveal and what you conceal. This phrase perhaps refers to this matter, that some individuals may sometimes misuse this exception and enter uninhabited homes on the pretext of this ordinance to find out some secrets. Or they sometimes enter some inhabited houses on the excuse that they did not know they are inhabited. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is aware of all these affairs. He knows well about those who misuse and going to public places while having no beneficial aim and only for wandering and going on about is often forbidden. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the World with Reporters.
Tehran has hosted a conference to discuss the effects of sanctions on the health of patients. Speaking at the event, Secretary of the Strategic Council of Foreign Relations Abbas Araghchi rejected the U.S. claims that medicine and food items are exempted from sanctions.
There might be such a thing on the surface, but in practice, the actions taken by the U.S. administration have imposed a strong sanction in this area. The U.S. sanctions against Iran cover a very wide network, and in addition to the humanitarian exceptions that they have apparently placed in the field of medicine, there are very detailed conditions by the Office of Foreign Assets Control of the U.S. Treasury Department in a way that makes their implementation practically impossible for pharmaceutical companies.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has led to a disruption in the accessibility of vital medical supplies for Iranian patients.
The most important report in this matter was submitted to the UN Human Rights Council last year by Mrs. Duhan, the special rapporteur on unilateral coercive measures of the United Nations. The U.S. and the West, self-proclaimed advocates of human rights, were against this report and even voted against the resolution to extend her mission. Even during her report presentation in September last year, they chose not to be present in the meeting hall. Self-criticism is not within their tolerance.
Although the U.S. claims that the sanctions do not directly ban the sales of medicines to Iran, they block every financial route needed to obtain drugs for patients suffering from diseases such as diabetes, kidney failure, hemophilia, multiple sclerosis, thalassemia, and leukemia.
Iranian officials have repeatedly condemned the sanctions against the Iranian nation as a crime against humanity, saying such unilateral restrictive measures have put the lives of vulnerable people at risk by hampering their access to medicine. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed to address the pressing cost of living crisis plaguing the nation. Attributing the situation to the global economic downturn, Erdogan has assured that his government will swiftly resolve this issue while upholding his promises to the people impacted by the devastating Fethi earthquake. He had previously pledged to complete the reconstruction efforts within a year.
We vow to tackle the escalating cost of living caused by global crisis. We are aware that the cost of living has been suffocating our nation recently. As we have solved every problem of our country, I hope we will solve this problem again. We will not neglect anyone's right and will not leave anyone's expectations unanswered.
Analysts argue that this whole economic crisis is the result of wrong economic strategies and decisions made by the same ruling government for the past years, and they cannot fix what they have done now.
The people who created the problem and don't see it as a problem are very unlikely to fix it. For this reason, it's a naive to expect from the creator of the problem to solve the problem. I don't know on what basis the president is making these promises. He spoke about the cost of living, which has been getting higher for the past 2 years. Every month, we have a new raises in prices from foodstuff to rents and fuel. When the new government came and Memi Shimshik was appointed, we waited for something positive to happen. But the lira value against US dollar is dropping, and we are not seeing any new investments in the country. So where are all the new policies they want implement?
A few weeks ago, the vice president said that a new economic plan is to be revealed in September that will have a positive impact on the life of citizens, production and market, saying this plan will increase investments in the country.
Turkey, after the pandemic, was facing a few economic issues, just like other countries in the world, struggling to encounter post-lockdown repercussions, and then came the devastating earthquake, and then elections. So what we are facing, from inflation to change in lira value, is normal to what country has been going through. However, I think the government's plan will ease the economic crisis, but it will take time, of course. When speaking about the economy, nothing can happen in one night.
This is why inflation is gaining a new momentum. The annual inflation went up from 38.2% to 47.8% in a single month in July. lack of economic investments, inflation, low Turkish lira value against the US dollar, and high cost of living. This is how the Turkish economy is going now, with some blaming the pandemic and earthquake, while others say it is the government's wrong economic decisions. Amid the government promises and opposition criticism regarding Erdogan's extended tenure, there remains uncertainty regarding the potential success of the newly appointed economic team in swiftly executing their plans.
It's not that bad. Yes, the Turkish lira value has dropped and the cost of living has risen, but the government also raised the minimum wage and is trying to solve the economic problems which occurred due to the earthquake.
The ruling party must act fast to solve this economic crisis ahead of an upcoming critical local election, which will determine the fate of Istanbul, Ankara, and other major cities. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Around 800 delegates from 76 countries have arrived at the International Military Technical Forum held in Moscow region. Their presence showed a desire to strengthen and develop mutually beneficial cooperation with Russia, despite the West's anti-Russian sanctions. Addressing the participants, President Vladimir Putin noted that the U.S., along with NATO members, use all military and non-military means to pressure nations into submitting to their will, adding that all this is taking place amid a disintegrating arms control framework.
In particular, the United States intent on reformatting the existing system of interstate relations in the Asia-Pacific region as it deems fit. In fact, efforts to promote these so-called Indo-Pacific strategies are aimed at creating U.S.-led military and political associations. We cannot exclude that these efforts may pave the way to fully integrate NATO forces with the AUKUS structures as they take shape.
Putin stated Ukraine as a case which demonstrates where the Western policy of pouring oil on fire leads.
By pumping billions of dollars into the neo-Nazi regime and supplying it with equipment, arms and munitions, sending military advisors and mercenaries there, they are doing everything to further escalate the conflict and draw other countries into it.
According to the Russian Defense Minister, Ukraine's military resource is almost exhausted and a special military operation has shown that there is nothing invulnerable to Russian weapons on the battlefield today.
No one should have any illusions that against the backdrop of a special military operation, Russian interests can be harmed. I wanted to draw attention to the fact that we also have cluster munitions in service. Until now, for humanitarian reasons, we have refrained from using them. However, this decision may be reconsidered.
This year, the forum is widely represented by weapons and military equipment that have already proven efficient in action. According to the Russian Defense Minister, the Russian army is expected to sign contracts worth over $4.7 billion at the forum. Iran has also presented a whole range of new combat drones.
Russia has expressed its determination to deepen technological partnerships and military technical cooperation with other countries and also continue taking advantage of the already established cooperation ties. The Army Expo's success is a clear indication that the West has lost most of its power in forcing countries to bend to its will. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
For the fourth time in 5 months, ex-President Donald Trump has been indicted and will be forced to stand trial, this time over alleged 2020 election interference in the state of Georgia. Ex-New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani joins Trump and nearly 20 others who will be collectively tried for violating a law normally associated with gangsters.
The indictment alleges that rather than abide by Georgia's legal process for election challenges, the defendants engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election result.
A conviction of racketeering in Georgia has a minimum prison sentence of 5 years. Polls have Trump as a certain lock to win the Republican presidential nomination, and he's neck and neck with incumbent President Joe Biden for next year's election.
Trump has gained 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down, as the spate of court cases has many accusing the ruling party of persecuting political opponents.
I definitely think it's a witch hunt because, I mean, it's like crying wolf. How many times are they going to say he's indicted? And I just think, I do believe that it's also election interference. I believe that they really don't want him to run the establishment. I believe that they want to keep Biden in office.
A recent poll found that 12% of America says that the use of force is justified to keep Trump from winning the presidency, while 7% of Trump supporters say force is justified to restore Trump to the presidency.
I absolutely support it. And, I was just talking to my son yesterday when the fourth came through. And I'm like, you know, it's just hard for me to imagine that you could have someone, the leader of one of the world's best countries or used to be in the world, and he could try to overthrow a legitimate campaign vote. So, no, I'm all for the indictments.
The Georgia trial is the only of Trump's four indictments, which is likely to be televised. The indictments have often seemed timed to coincide to overshadow developments in the corruption allegations of Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden.
You know, we've been saying for a while that Trump is a criminal, and the issue is that we have a criminal system. So, Trump being indicted, we hope that he goes to jail. We hope that he goes to prison. I don't think that it's going to happen personally. But at the same time, you know, some of the people who are pushing these charges, you know, are also a part of this criminal system and also, you know, need to be held accountable for the things that they've done.
Trump's goal may be to delay the trials past the November 2024 vote, although he cannot pardon himself in the Georgia case, while Democrats are accused of slow-walking the investigations to tarnish Trump throughout the upcoming election campaign.
What the continued lawsuits make certain is that there will be no national reconciliation over the still disputed 2020 election, only further estrangement, and with no end in sight. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
On the 17th anniversary of the 2006 Israeli war against Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah underlined the prospects of the resistance front in the entire region.
I do not deny, as the Israeli war minister threatened, that they can take Lebanon back to the Stone Age. But I tell our enemy, based on evidence and facts, you also will be taken to the Stone Age. If you choose to go to war with Lebanon, you will be returned to the Stone Age. Our enemy can make a list of civilian and military obvious infrastructure in the area of occupied Palestine. They can calculate how many rockets the resistance needs to destroy all of these sites.
The Hezbollah leader stressed that the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the Resistance Alliance of the region have seized the initiative to a very high extent.
August 14, 2006, did not only signal the end of 33 days of Israeli hostilities, but it ushered in a new phase in the Israeli-Arab conflict. For the first time since its creation, Israel has been deterred from launching a new aggression for 17 years.
Western and Israeli reports published since the end of the 2006 war and until today mentioned that Hezbollah had a decisive victory over Israel with a lasting impact.
Any Western who has a freedom or was liberal to say the truth would do nothing but acknowledge the truth about the resistance and honor them, because in their books and their reports they acknowledge that those people performed very highly and they were not scared and they were facing the tanks and the airplanes and all of this with their humble weapons. But as the other brother said, but they had a spirit that the Israeli will never have because they're fighting for good cause.
Observers believe the war has set the cornerstone for a new age for the peoples of this region and the whole world.
What this victory has done to the mentalities is building a new way of thinking, way of victorizing against the enemies, especially the West and its culture. They cannot invade us again.
Israel's aggression killed around 1,300 Lebanese, mostly civilians. It destroyed thousands of residential buildings and houses and severely damaged Lebanese civil infrastructure and displaced approximately 1 million Lebanese. Maryam Saleh, Mlita, South Lebanon.
Groundwater pollution has reached an alarming level in the Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants, posing grave risks for Gazans. Israel has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars. Water pollution poses serious health risks throughout the tiny coastal sliver.
The Israeli continuous blockade has severe implications on the situation of water in Gaza. 97% of the Gaza aquifer water is polluted due to the destruction happened on the last offensives that we witnessed in Gaza Strip.
More than 2 million Gazans are forced to buy filtered water in order to cook or drink. Tap water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. People only use it for house cleaning and doing the laundry.
Tap water is not suitable for drinking, and I think it's not even good for animals to drink. Tap water makes us sick, and we only use it to wash our clothes and to clean the house. My family spends a lot of money to buy filtered water. We only use filtered water to cook and drink.
Inhumane Israeli practices have taken their toll on the coastal sliver's drinking water. Water contamination levels are at least 3 times higher than the standards of the World Health Organization for safe drinking water.
More than 97% of Gaza's groundwater is polluted and does not meet the standards of the World Health Organization. The blockade and repeated Israeli military operations and the direct targeting of Gaza's vital infrastructure have also caused damage to water systems and affected water supply networks, further exacerbating the already existing water crisis.
The consumption of contaminated water at levels over international safety standards can cause potentially life-threatening diseases.
Years of Israeli siege and multiple wars since 2008 have devastated Gaza's water infrastructure and led to increasing levels of pollution in drinking water supplies. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Afghan women's restaurant is situated in the capital, Kabul, and serves traditional Afghan food. The restaurant is decorated with colorful fabrics, handicrafts, and flowers, and it is known for being run by and for women. The owners say it is a safe haven for women who want to enjoy a meal, socialize, and express themselves freely.
This restaurant is established to serve and help women. All of our employees and customers are women. We wanted to create a space where women can feel comfortable and hopeful and enjoy tasty Afghan traditional food. It's also aimed at offering jobs to women who are left without an income.
The women who work at the facility say they started working here after the Taliban banned them from other jobs and education. They call on the de facto government to reverse the restrictions on women's rights.
I was a student of law when the Taliban enforced the ban on universities. At the time, I felt so bad and depressed. In addition, our family was running out of money. Then I decided to join this restaurant. It is very beneficial and helpful for me. I call on the Taliban to restore our rights to work and education.
The restaurant is popular among women who come here to enjoy the food and the atmosphere. The customers say they appreciate the service and the solidarity that they find here.
I am a 12th grade student. I visit this restaurant because it is run by and for women. I come here to study, have Afghan hand-baked food, and socialize with my friends. I also want to meet new people and chat with them. I'm happy that at least we have this opportunity and service.
The restaurant is a rare example of women's empowerment and resistance in a country where the Taliban have imposed strict restrictions on women's rights. Despite the challenges and risks, Afghan women are not giving up on their dreams and aspirations. They're supportive of each other in the face of the imposed restrictions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, not passing judgment while we are hungry or thirsty. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear friends, we are talking about an Islamic lifestyle. And it's interesting, one thing that is part and parcel of an Islamic lifestyle is that one way or the other, we're going to be making judgments, right? Whether we are judging between friends, we are judging between co-workers, we are judging between our children, or we are in a position of judgment, whether we are handing out blessings, we are handing out rewards, or we are handing out punishments. In one way or the other, we are very intimately connected to this idea of judgment. One of the things that we have been recommended by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam is to never make a judgment while we are angry. And we explained that in one of our episodes previously. But another thing that we have been told to be wary of is to make judgments while we are hungry or thirsty. And it is actually related by the Imams and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam that one must not make a judgment while they are hungry or thirsty. Now, kind of doesn't make sense, but if you think about it, actually it makes a lot of sense. Because so when one is angry, one is under the influence of anger and cannot make clear decisions. And likewise, when a person is overly hungry, you know, they're starving or they are very thirsty, then these aspects of hunger and thirst also take over their rational thinking and cloud their judgment. And so, of course, when your judgment becomes clouded, then you are expected to make the wrong kind of judgments. And so, of course, this is what we learn from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, that one must try to avoid making judgments while one is hungry and or thirsty. Welcome back, dear friends. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we were talking about making judgments, and we had said in the previous segment that, you know, we are always in a position of making judgments, you know, whether it is to pass rewards or to pass on punishment, whether it is admonishing or giving advice or reprimanding. In one way or the other, in our Islamic lifestyle, we are definitely passing judgment, and not in the negative sense, but in the positive sense. You know, we are constantly in a position where we have to judge between friends, we have to judge between co-workers, we need to judge between family members, we need to judge between siblings, we need to judge between children. And so judgment and passing judgment and being fair and being just is really something that is integral and part and parcel of our Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, we should not take this in vain or with the grain of salt. We really need to take these things seriously, and we must be very careful when passing these different kind of judgments, and we should seek refuge in Allah and ask help from the Almighty Allah so that we are able to pass good, sane, fair judgments. And of course, in order to be able to pass these judgments and to be fair and to be equitable and to be just, there are certain requirements. And one of those, as we have said, is this idea that one should not be hungry or thirsty. We want to extrapolate just a little bit as we end the program. What is being said, yes, anger, hunger, and thirst, these are things that are specifically said that they hamper judgment. But what is being said overall, which is something to take into consideration, is this idea that anything that comes in the way or prevents or is an obstacle or is a barrier to be able to make sound judgments is something that we must refrain from while we are making a judgment.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.com.